the entire chicken chimichanga lunch. The shock of this should have sobered me up. It did not. I was still high, still sluggish, sitting with my bare ass on a toilet, a lava field of puke all over the floor. Often when I am alone, and especially when I am drunk, I talk out loud to myself. Apparently, I also do this when I am high. "Well, this is tragic," I said. "You have to clean this up right now. Can you imagine a poor park ranger coming in here and seeing this? He'd quit." I was trying to make myself laugh. I think I was smiling. I looked around for any kind of help. There was a sink and a paper towel dispenser. It was empty. I stood up, stepped out of my shorts and underwear, and walked over to the sink. I lifted first one leg into the sink and washed it off, then the other. I threw my underwear away. I rinsed out my shorts. I scrubbed my shoes. I got massive wads of toilet paper, the thin kind that disintegrates when wet, and began scooping the chimichanga mountain into the toilet, one double-handed scoop at a time. I was still so high. I don't know how long I was there on all fours, scrubbing and scooping, ass in the air, soaking my shorts and shoes in the sink. It could have been 3 hours or 20 minutes. Once the floor was clean, I spent God knows how long wringing out my shorts to get them dry. I put them on. I put my shoes on. I looked around the room, slowly, blurry, proud of my cleaning job, ashamed of my chimichanga. I opened the door and thought, no one will know what just happened behind this closed door. I did feel better, still high as a satellite, but my stomach didn't hurt anymore. I floated through the dark toward our campsite. Weston was standing out in the road, away from our hammocks, visibly upset. "Where have you been?" he demanded. "In the bathroom," I said. "I didn't feel well." "There's something in our campsite," Weston said, with the truest tone of fear. "There's a man walking around our hammocks in the dark." Weston's knees were bent and he was bobbing, ready to run or fight. I was too high and tired for this. "You're sure it isn't a raccoon? You think there's a man crawling around in the bushes around our hammocks? I doubt that." "Dude, I heard it," he exclaimed. "It was too big to be a raccoon. Maybe 5 raccoons. What if it's a serial killer on the loose, or a homeless guy on meth?" He was sincerely scared. "You are high, so am I. I didn't hear anything, so I don't care," I said. "I hope it kills me." I walked with determination into our campsite and crawled into my hammock. My sleeping bag was crumpled underneath me, and I fought for what felt like forever to get my feet in it. Weston watched for a while, then, seeing that I wasn't scared, crawled into his hammock and went to sleep. I woke up rested and sober and hoping that the chimichanga incident had been a dream. But I saw that I wasn't wearing underwear. My shorts were still wet, my shoes still soaked. Over instant coffee and lukewarm water, I informed Weston that my weed days were over. Chapter 4. The Temptation of Home, Southern California. 13,162 miles to go. We biked into San Luis Obispo and stayed a day there. The next day, we would ride to Pismo Beach and meet up with Weston's mom, who'd decided to come out and visit us. I'd never met her before. Weston was excited for the reunion, but apprehensive. He had a charged way of talking about his family and his childhood, a lack of stability, lack of security, but love, too. We biked into Pismo and along the beach to a narrow house on the sand. Their family friend or some uncle owned it, I can't remember. As we pulled into the driveway, Weston's mom and stepdad stood waiting to greet us. "Boys, you made it," his mom shouted. "Jed, it's so nice to meet you. I'm Linda. I've heard so much about you. If my boy is going to go off and do something crazy like this, I'm glad it's with you." "Linda, so nice to meet you. Thank you," I said. "I've heard so much about you, too." That wasn't true, but I always say that. "Come in. We've already cooked up a feast." We chained up our bikes and carried our panniers inside the house. There was a guest room on the first floor by the garage. Then upstairs was a big, long room with windows facing the ocean and the broad beach. She had pizza boxes open on the table. Weston made eyes at me as if referencing the junk food. We ate ravenously and drank our Cokes with the TV on, and they asked us questions about camping and sleeping and bikes and charging our phones. "Has Weston tried any of his theories on you yet?" Linda asked. "What do you mean?" I asked. "Well, he's always into some new idea. I just quit listening. You can't take it too seriously. He'll be on to the next thing in a few days. He's just so passionate," she said. I already knew this about Weston's personality, but it was different to hear it from his mother. Weston didn't protest. She was performing in front of him for me, speaking to me, but effectively speaking to him. In high school, he was so Christian, which I didn't like. Then he was atheist, and now he's what? What are you, honey, vegan? "No, Mom," she picked up on his frustration. "Oh, baby, you know I love you, and I'll support you whatever you believe. I just get whiplash is all." I thought about Weston in a new way after seeing him with his mom. He wasn't a caricature, no matter what his antics. He was a whole person, shaped by nature and circumstances. Later, while Weston read Siddhartha and his parents watched TV, I tried to get more intentional with my journaling. It hurts to write by hand if I do it for too long, which pushes me to keep my language tight and right. The permanence of pen on paper means something. You say it, and it's there. And if you change your mind, the scribbled out words are still there. No pretending you're perfect. For me, thoughts and emotions stay cloudy until I put them into words, give them bodies to walk around in and be their own thing. That's when they become knowable. I also tried to draw maps of my trips, old-timey ones that look like a field guide Darwin would carry. I love old drawings and the sketches of cities and animals from ancient field guides. I like timeless things, old things. They've made it to the modern age and taken on a meaning larger than their intention. I wanted my journal to be like that. There's a weird paradox in trying to live a meaningful life, one that you will talk about and tell about. There is the present experience of the living, but also the separate eye, watching from above, already seeing the living from the outside. Darwin and Steinbeck wrote alone, by hand, in leather-bound books that only later found an audience. Still, they wrote as if to an audience, with the presumption that someone, one day, would read their private work. Is this so different than what I was doing on Instagram? It feels cheap to make the comparison, but maybe it's not. We stayed just one night, all Weston could seem to handle, and packed up to head out in the morning. Out in the driveway again and ready to roll, Weston's mom said, "Okay, boys, be safe. Weston, I love you. Jed, take care of him, okay?" Weston hugged her loosely and pulled away before her hug was finished, kissed her on the cheek, and we biked away. From Pismo, we biked away from the coast into the golden hills of Central California. The farms and dusty oak trees and gentleman farmer ranches sprawled on both sides of us. Born and raised in Tennessee, I have always wanted hills and trees. I trust land like that. Flat land and barren desert threaten my sense of understanding. I cannot get my bearings, I have no point of reference, and can't wait to leave. But around hills, trees, streams, and valleys, I want to linger. This part of California does that to me. I want to know every stream bed and hill. I want to climb into the rafters of every barn. But I think it must matter where you were raised. I have friends from the Mississippi Delta who can't stand land like this because they can't see the sky behind the hill. They don't trust it. They need the sky and land to be wide open. And I have friends from Palm Springs who feel claustrophobic around too many trees. They want the land to be naked and honest, with no secrets. We cycled over the mountain pass on Highway 154 and down into Santa Barbara. Behind us, mountain ramparts too steep and wild to be developed protected it from the hot, dry interior, and the smaller hills, dotted with perfect Spanish homes, seemed to crawl on all fours down to the ocean. Santa Barbara is one of those places that's so beautiful it can feel like you've wandered into a European postcard. The San Ynez Mountains are steep and green behind the coastal hills of town. They push the city right up on the Pacific Ocean, with mansions and Spanish cottages covering the hills. From the coast, you can see the Channel Islands, long and large, a jagged sleeping dragon in the water some 20 miles offshore. The place is so picturesque, the Mediterranean climate so pleasant, that it gives me pause. This kind of perfection can breed something like arrogance in those who live there. I've met many lovely people from Santa Barbara, but I don't think I would raise my children there. I'm not sure any of us are at our best living in paradise. From Santa Barbara to Los Angeles, the wild coast of California that feels too mean and holy to belong to anyone lost some of its agency. This was the manicured, bought, sold, developed, regulated coast of Southern California. Still beautiful, still wild in many ways, but it felt more like real estate than nature. The best beach houses, the best cliffs, the best coves, but owned by someone else. And the public beaches are covered in signs and controlled by rules. We spent a full week in Los Angeles. It was a welcome home and a send-off at the same time. And oh my God, you're actually doing it, week of celebrations. It felt good. The muscle that knows routine takes time to be reprogrammed. And being in the city with my friends, going to our old restaurants, sitting on the same old couches, watching the same shows and laughing, it felt like our trip had only been a weekend excursion and not a real life-altering choice. All week, my mind flirted dangerously with this comfort. I was at my friend Willow's house, on the couch, watching old episodes of Breaking Bad and feeling incredibly normal. I sat on the couch I'd sat on 1,000 times, drank the same Trader Joe's wine I'd always drunk, and made the same jokes with my friends. "So you're actually doing it. You've already biked 1,000 miles, my friend Jenny said. Feels so weird having you back on the couch, like it's not real. I know. I feel like I haven't started yet, though. I have 9,000 more miles. It feels fake. She laughed. You aren't on some epic adventure. You're the same asshole who dances to see you with me in the kitchen. You're a scam. I won't be a scam when I bike out of Los Angeles in 2 days. That's not happening. You can't leave us. Just Google some photos of South America and post them to Instagram and make shit up. No one will ever know. Weston and I stayed on the east side of L.A. in a hilly neighborhood called Los Feliz. It is composed of old houses restored and preserved by artists and actors. It feels like the kind of place Joan Didion would have lived, smoking cigarettes and watching musicians and actors experimenting in excess. The surrounding neighborhoods play host to the culture makers of Los Angeles, from Beechwood Canyon to Los Feliz, Atwater Village to Silver Lake, Highland Park to Echo Park, to Lincoln Heights, to the Arts District downtown. The key to living happily in L.A. is localization. Newcomers try to have lunch in Venice and dinner in Studio City and end up losing their minds. The traffic turns visiting these towns, only 10 or 15 miles apart, into day trips. People love to blame a place for their own failures. Los Angeles is the king of this. So many people move here to chase a dream, or to escape the cold, or to escape their family. The city is supposed to be the answer to their discontent, to whatever it was that rejected them at home. And in their mind, simply having the bravery to get out west deserves fanfare. But once here, they find that no one cares about them as much as they do. If vanity drove them to this city, they discover that vanity doesn't like peers. It likes followers. In a city that feeds off the big fish small pond kids, they discover a big pond swarming with over-the-top talent and perfect bone structure. The moment I got to USC, I was humbled by the caliber of human beings. Back in Nashville, I thought I was the next Spielberg. But in L.A., I was just another wannabe. I discovered this when a friend of mine was directing a short film for class and I offered to help. On set, there were 15 people, lists and lists, rented equipment, lights, a boom, walkie-talkies. I stood on the tiny set and thought, this looks terrible, all that pressure, my God. I felt a spinning sense of loss when I realized I wouldn't be a director. But it was the first time in my life where I learned the difference between dreams and goals. Each of us has a mashup of talents and experiences and potential that plants something in us and becomes a dream. A dream of being a creative or an executive or a father. A dream is the myriad ways we could be fulfilled in life using our talents to make beautiful things. But then there are goals. Goals are specific guesses at what we could do or become to fulfill our dream. Dreams are like a compass that points in a general direction, and goals are the islands in the ocean along the way. Goals are just guesses at where to make a home, and when they aren't right, we try another. It isn't a death, and it doesn't negate the dream. I had mistaken the goal for the dream at USC, and in that moment, Los Angeles could have eaten me up. Instead, my confusion eventually led me to law school, which led me to my charity work, which led me to this bike trip. You could say I was saved from misdirection by not being too handsome or too talented or too ambitious. After a dangerously comfortable week in LA, eating tacos and telling stories like we'd been on our bike tour for a year, we headed south on a hot, sunny day. We pedaled along Santa Monica Boulevard, where cars choked the roads and we needed to be agile and all-seeing. But my bike was so heavy, I couldn't turn on a dime or make a quick decision. Weston, who packed virtually nothing and rode shirtless, moved as if weightless. I made a wide left turn onto La Cienega, and a car screeched its tires to avoid me and honked. It was that sustained, angry honk when the person holds it many seconds too long to signal to you and the world how sinful you are, not just your action, but your whole being. Fortunately, Weston had mapped a way to bike along the cement canyons of the Los Angeles River and its tributaries. Once we made our way into a canal bike path, the world slowed down. I felt safe again, cruising through a part of Los Angeles I'd never seen. As if layered on top of my familiar streets, or maybe beneath, was a highway for cyclists, a parallel universe of ways to get from A to B. I felt like a stranger in my own city. In the beach cities of the South Bay, an area in the southern part of Los Angeles County, the cycle path emptied out onto the Pacific Coast Highway. From there, we made the easy ride through Orange County, stayed with Weston's cousin, and then on to the coastal military base of Camp Pendleton. We tried to bike through the base, but the soldiers wouldn't let Weston in. "You have to wear a helmet on a military base if you're riding a bicycle," the soldier said. "Okay, but come on, we just have to get to San Diego, and we're riding to South America. You can let us through," Weston said. "No, you'll have to turn around and ride down Interstate 5. "You're joking," Weston protested with attitude. "You'll have to turn around and ride down Interstate 5. Weston fumed as we rode on the shoulder of the interstate. Apart from this military base, Southern California's coast is one giant connected suburb. This makes it feel easier to bike across. The ride to San Diego took 2 days. Once in San Diego, Weston and I felt something new, ominous, and exciting. The gravitational pull of the Mexican border. The crossing point from known to unknown. From my language to their language. From trusting myself to trusting God. From me being right to my mom's worst fears coming true. We were drinking craft beer around a fire in a friend's backyard. A law school buddy named Michael Gonzalez joined us. We called him Tank. He grew up in a Mexican community outside LA, and he'd made so many jokes about imagining my scrawny white ass in Mexico that I invited him over to teach me how to make it down there. "Tank, so I know I was supposed to learn Spanish, but I got busy. Whatever, I suck," I laughed. The anxiety of crossing the border into another world had wiped my brain's hard drive, and I had lost what little Spanish I'd picked up for my single week of using Rosetta Stone. "At least I tried," I said. "Weston doesn't know shit." "Hey," objected Weston. "I'm good with my hands, and that includes hand gestures and also smiling." "Boys," Tank said, taking on an uncharacteristic fatherly tone. "You'll be fine. No one is nicer than Mexicans. When your food's that good, you're nicer." "Okay, so tell me some music to listen to so I can connect with the people," I said. "Like modern music?" "No, like what is so classic Mexico that anyone in any village will like me more for knowing it?" "Oh, I know. Vicente Fernandez," he said, springing up in his chair. "He is el rey de la música ranchera, the king of ranchera music. He's like a cowboy Sinatra. Just go around singing, volver, volver, you'll make friends everywhere you go." Tank taught me some other phrases in Spanish. "Excuse me, sir, my bicycle is broken. Do you know the closest bike shop?" "I am lost. Which way is town?" "Do you have any water?" I couldn't count to 20. I was frozen. Sure, I was excited to discover Mexico, and I led with that emotion. But beneath that, my animal brain was terrified. Ahead, 760 miles of desert. Hot sun, cacti, hardly any people, hardly any towns. Could I carry enough water? Would a rattlesnake get me too far from town? We drank more beers, and the fire crackled as I stared off in thought. I was scared. I felt the weight of the duty too much to enjoy everything that was ahead of me. What if I hated it? What if it didn't give me the revelations I asked for? What if I failed? What if risking it all was a scam, a selfish worship of the grass being greener everywhere but here? But that's not what I said to Tank. "I'm so excited. Ah! I just want to be on the road sleeping with the coyotes," I said, my eyes a bit glazed. We cheersed our beers, and Weston took a long drag of his joint. Tank was speaking to me in Spanish. He said something about tarantulas. That would have to do for now. Part 2. Mexico. Chapter 5. Crossing into Baja. 12,765 miles to go. The final night in San Diego, we slept on the floor of my friend's house. We wanted to cross the border pretty early. I was tired and thought I'd fall right asleep. I didn't. I just lay on the carpet staring at the ceiling fan above me, my stomach in knots. We had been on the road for 5 weeks. I'd learned how to change a pop's tire, and my tailbone had grown immune to the ache of the bike seat. I knew how to find a camping spot during the golden hour. I knew how to hide my bike from the road. I knew how to ride 60 miles a day and how much water and food to replenish each day. I knew where to put the food in my pannier so I could reach back and pull it out as I cycled. But tomorrow we would cross the border and ride through Tijuana to Rosarito, Mexico. I woke up with the sun. I got up and rubbed my eyes and walked with heavy, sleepy legs into the kitchen, where Weston was making pour-over coffee. He turned to me, bright as Bo Peep. "Good morning, you pale Mexican. We got to get to our home country." I shook my head and laughed and yawned all at once. "You excited?" he asked. "I am, but a bit numb to it, too. Doesn't feel real," I said. "Yeah, I wish I'd learned a little Spanish right about now. I mean, I did take it in high school, but where did all those words go? Oh, well, that's the adventure. I'll just mime my way to Patagonia." Our friends woke up and we made eggs and dragged our feet. I kept unpacking and repacking. I kept worrying about water. "Oh, shoot. Do I need to run by REI and get another water bag? I don't know if I have enough," I said. "Dude, you have a 10-gallon bladder. That is insane. People live in Baja. They drink water. We'll be fine," Weston said. His tiny panniers seemed ludicrous. I wondered if I'd have to provide water for both of us. He was so confident we'd be okay. I appreciated that and hated it. Finally, we put our bikes in the back of a friend's truck, and he drove us to the border. I've read that the San Diego-Tijuana border runs down the middle of the largest wealth gap in the world. On the American side, the stucco-tracked homes with Spanish tile roofs of San Diego, with green lawns and flowers and wide, clean roads. Then a barren stretch of swamp and brush about half a mile wide that touches the border. Then begin the fences. Our side has fences made of tall cement tubes, layered together like a zipper and driven into the earth like an alien art installation. The tubes are separated by enough space for a fox or a cat to slip through, but not a person. On the Mexican side, they have a fence too, rusted and brown and flaking, nailed together like a hippie quilt. San Diego's cliffs are made lush and green by water piped in from faraway mountains. In Tijuana, the same cliffs are parched and flaky. Passing from the United States into Mexico is very easy. If you go by car, they don't even stop you. Weston and I walked our bikes across a cement bridge and down a winding zigzag ramp and found the passport check. There was virtually no line, maybe 15 people in front of us. The signs led us into a small room with aging white walls yellowing at the top. The fluorescent lights above were tired. We were causing quite the inconvenience, wheeling our fat bikes with us in the cramped hallway. But there was nowhere to lock them, and we were cautious about Mexico already, words from my mother sneaking in. Mexico is dangerous. They behead tourists if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Look at these headlines. It's a war zone down there. Why don't you bike across Canada? At the front of the line, the woman at the desk asked how long we were staying. We're taking our bikes from here to the southern border, so about 60 days, I think, I said. She looked up. Really? She said, with consternation. Yeah, wanna come? Weston said. She let herself smile and then laughed. Absolutely not, and stamped our passports. We walked our bikes over one more bridge and into Tijuana. Weston was barefoot, which he noted out loud as we entered Mexico. We got on our bikes and rode into immediate chaos. No shoulder, no sidewalk. Roads and overpasses and busy cars everywhere. Everyone driving like they're racing to the ER with their wife in labor. Some of the buildings looked new. Others, right beside the new buildings, were falling apart. There seemed to be no plan, no uniformity, no grid. Without a shoulder to the road, we tried to stay as far to the right in the lane as possible, but this only made things more dangerous. Rusted trucks tumbled past just inches away, and drivers got honking furious at us when, unable to find a pattern or direction, we had to cross lanes at the last minute. I counted three dead dogs, mangled from being run over dozens of times. It is one of the few times in my life I have feared death. The sound of screeching tires and honking horns followed us the entire 2 hours from the center of the city to the quieter beach road. The final exit out of town and toward the beach required a dash across four heavily trafficked lanes to an exit ramp that wrapped around to the quiet coastal road. Weston made it over fast and easy, and I tried to follow. But as I crossed, the truck speeding toward me slammed on its brakes. It skidded and fishtailed before coming to a complete stop only 5 feet away. The man never honked. Actually, he looked as terrified as I did. Holy shit, Weston said when I'd made it across. You almost died. I know, I said, but the adrenaline pumped so thickly through my veins that death could only feel like a joke. Once outside Tijuana, the road turned into a two-lane highway, freshly paved, smooth and beautiful, all the way through Rosarito. This beach town caters to college kids who want to party, in beach clubs with thatched roof bars and tattooed DJs. The hills above Rosarito and the cliffs over the ocean are dotted with pretty houses, similar to ones you'd see in San Diego or Orange County. But here, tucked between the mansions, you can see shacks and tiny box homes, some resembling a turned-over dumpster. But even many of these seem to sit right above the surf, with laundry hung out to dry and a few plastic chairs to enjoy the view. Our plan for the day was to make it halfway to Ensenada, a city 60 miles down the coast, where a few friends had rented a beach house for the weekend. They had invited us to crash with them. By the time we were riding out of Rosarito, I had worked off the adrenaline rush, and my muscles had turned shaky and then very tired. South of town, the landscape gave way to brown and gold hills against the ocean with white stucco houses haphazardly dotted up the hillsides. Folks here enjoyed the exact same climate as San Diego, but with a tenth of the trees. That's because most of Southern California's trees are imported and kept alive by imported water. It took me years to figure out why Los Angeles looked so verdant and yet so strange. Tijuana and Rosarito showed me the answer. In its natural state, the land is nearly treeless. Save for the oaks that hide in canyons, Southern California is a man-made garden. Finally, we were seeing what the land is supposed to look like. We met up with our friends by golden hour, and they were an excited welcoming committee. They poured us margaritas, and we cooked dinner and told the story of cycling through Tijuana. "Those roads are crazy. You guys are crazy," one friend said, inspecting our heavy bikes and gear. "Everything you have is on these bikes? That's all you have?" "Yep, this is it. Trying to simplify. Take only what I need," Weston said. "Wow." We felt cool and rugged, but the adrenaline come down had us asleep on the couch by 9 p.m., while our friends played beer pong just feet away. The next day, we woke up early, said our goodbyes, and headed out. We cycled south along the beautiful two-lane road, passing by the several toll booths that paid for the paved road. The path looked similar to the coastal route above Santa Barbara, and it felt familiar and comforting. Maybe Mexico wouldn't be as wild as we thought. By mid-afternoon, we had made it to my old roommate's dad's house in Ensenada. This was the last stop in the chain of homes we had been offered by friends, the southernmost point of connections with the familiar. It was a nice house that sat above town on a hill overlooking the main drag of restaurants and tourist shops. We had the place to ourselves. We stayed a week, eating tacos and practicing our dismal Spanish, thinking it would help us adjust to Mexico before heading south into the Baja Peninsula, the thousand-mile stretch of scattered towns and hateful sunshine. We were at the last stop sign before the wilderness. In my blog reading, I had found several detailed accounts of cycling Baja. Bring lots of water. Hammocks won't work because there aren't trees. Tarantulas. There is no shoulder, so trucks will get very close and blow you off the road. Yikes. The Baja Peninsula is a long leg of land, like Florida, but thinner, and almost twice as long. She is as dry as a million-year drought. Crispy mountains run down her spine, splaying out in the direction of the two coasts. The desert is unbroken, and natural water is scarce. The unforgiving land prevents many people from calling the peninsula home. And yet, archaeologists have discovered caves with paintings of deer dated at 10,000 years old. Humans have been scrappy, tough bastards for so long. Baja is the sinister cousin of Southern California, with similar sunshine, waves, and mountains, but California has water, bled from the snowmelt of faraway mountains. We funnel it into our valleys and turn California into a garden. Baja, on the other hand, is surrounded by ocean and doesn't have distant mountains to catch moisture. This turns the peninsula into a thorny, rocky, angry thigh bone with almost zero fresh water. Baja would be our first true test. Were we cyclists, adventurers, or just fragile tourists? On the third day, after reading every blog, I made a shopping list. Beans to cook, lots of water, I bought 10 extra tire tubes, which is too many, cans of tuna and almonds and peanut butter. On our fourth night in Ensenada, after reading all the blogs and buying gallons of water and watching Back to the Future on VHS, Weston and I found a pool hall on a back road far from the tourist zone. The place had 20 tables. The ceiling was low and black, and people at the bar were smoking. A few exposed light bulbs hung from the ceiling over the tables, and one of them had a green chandelier intact from a more ornate time. From the moment we walked in, we were under the watch from the locals. Clearly, this place was not a spot where tourists often showed up, which made it perfect. We bought Tecate beers and started playing pool. Weston and I had now been together a month. I felt safe with him. He cooked and fixed tires and could do anything with duct tape. He never complained, unless it was about society at large. We'd become the type of comrades who can spend the day in silence, existing together, thinking independently, then spring into conversation out of seemingly nowhere. "I like the heat," Weston said, as we worked our way around the table. "What heat?" I said. "The heat of the desert. But I don't like the cold nights. What do the blogs say about what's ahead?" "That we need to bring lots of water, and that there isn't any shoulder on the road, but that the truck drivers are nice, and the people in RVs aren't." "Like Big Sur, those fuckers, old white Republicans." After his shot, Weston gave a nod to some guys at the bar that were watching us. "I can't believe how many dead dogs we've already seen," I said. "The blogs say to expect more. Remember that huge bloated elk in Oregon we biked past? It looked like a hippo." "No, I didn't see it." "You were probably high." "Is that judgment I hear in your voice?" Weston asked, smiling. "No, no. I love cigarettes, but I don't think I fiend for them the way you fiend for weed." "I'm not addicted," Weston replied. "I feel called to it. When I smoke, it's like saying my prayers. Makes me present. There's a difference. One is a need, the other is a desire, a commitment." "Thou doth protest too much," I said, laughing. It was my turn to shoot. "Well, I'm no more addicted to this than you are to your phone. That little computer represents the world we're leaving, friends back home and screens. This flower is my connection to the present, to the unknown, to not planning, to letting life and this trip happen. Whatever," Weston chuckled, feeling like he was getting too intense. "I'll run out in this desert if I'm not careful. Might have to wait for Cabo or La Paz or wherever at the end. You'll see, it's a practice, not a need." "Touché," I said, not sure what I meant by it, but wanting to concede. Later that night, our last in Ensenada, we watched Jurassic Park on VHS. Pushing the tape into the player felt nostalgic and comforting. The movie did too. After 5 days spent avoiding the unknown, we were antsy to hit the road early. The next morning, a Thursday, brought blue skies. People were heading to work, and the city was waking up, and none of those people knew we were headed south to Patagonia. We cycled out of town, and the landscape abruptly turned rugged and rural. Tomato plantations stretched across the desert coast. Rows and rows of plants, of white tarps like tubes, protecting the plants from bugs or birds or dry heat. These farms were massive operations. They resembled what I could only imagine as terraforming, the apocalyptic future hope of colonizing Mars. The land looked dead and hostile, yet rows of planted green bushes bordered huge fields of tomatoes, as if to block them from view, as if to make the craziness look more lovely. The white plastic greenhouse alien structures numbered in the thousands. Trucks carried millions of tomatoes out onto Highway 1, headed to California, to the port of Tijuana, to the world. Highway 1 is the main thoroughfare of Baja, crisscrossing down the long desert arm all the way to Cabo. It is almost always paved, except for certain short stretches of construction, maybe a mile at a time, where the road is diverted to the lumpy, ribbed dirt on the shoulder, and biking becomes an organ-jostling nightmare. Every giant semi-truck and busted, rusted work truck, every sleek American RV, and a host of ancient vehicles takes this same road, basically the only road, each one zooming past us on our bikes. The potholes take their toll, and the side of the road is littered with rusty nails. Bits of metal, wires, coils, and even more roadkill than we saw in Tijuana. We biked in the beating sun, and the heat began to feel different from California's. Maybe it was the absence of trees. Maybe it was the heat-scorched, dusty roads. On the unpaved portions, the trucks would kick up blizzards of brown dust, which would cake our bodies and lips and force us to close our eyes and hold our breath until it was safe to breathe again. Travel felt different now. This felt like navigating a developing country. This reminded me of my time in Africa. I was no longer home, and this, or something a lot like it, was what we would expect for the next 14 months. The dust-blown, nail-dodging, pothole-hitting routine became the norm for a few days. And then, as the cruel sun finished its business, the worry would set in. Where to sleep? The rule of hiding from the road felt even more imperative here, because we would be trying to camp on people's farms, on Mexican ranchers' farms. I'd never met a Mexican rancher, but somehow a stereotype had formed in my imagination. They were mean. We looked for boulders to set up behind, for trees or cacti to hang our hammocks from. The only trees grew in riverbeds, and often in thickets. When we could find them, they were great for hiding in. We needed trees with strong branches or trunks to hold us up, and at a perfect distance of 8 or 12 feet across. Too close, and we'd sleep like a closed clam, which is impossible. Too far, and the ropes wouldn't reach. The idea was to be invisible. No one should see us leave the road, or be able to see our camp from a distance. And so, as the sun went down, we would ride with our eyes peeled for the right spot, hoping that whoever was riding in the front saw it too. Then, a possibility. A bridge with a dry riverbed. Some oak trees crowding by the edge, waiting for the rainy season. Maybe even a patch of green grass living off secret water below the sand. Or a pile of boulders with a sandy nook between them, just a few feet from the highway, but hidden from sight. We would set up, hang our hammocks, and crawl in with twilight still glowing. The thrill of trespassing every day, moving like tramps and ghosts, made us feel like cowboys delivering letters to an outpost 1,000 miles away and 100 years ago. A few mornings in and 200 miles down Baja, we woke to unbelievable cold. The afternoon before, without noticing, we had moved away from the ocean and its moderating influence. I could see my breath in the morning light as I peeked out of my sleeping bag and the taco of my hammock. I shuffled in my hammock to signal to Weston that I was awake. He was too. "You get out first," he said. "No, you, make a fire," I said. "Fuck no," he said. I acquiesced and slid like a worm out of my hammock and my sleeping bag and stood in the cold. This is hard. I knew it would be hard, but my muscles hurt, and it's cold. I hate this. "We need to dress quick and hit the road to get our blood going," Weston said. "I'm the one out of my hammock, come on," I said. We ate a few cookies and I drank coffee made in my water bottle from instant Nescafe powder and cold water. Then we took off. As I rode, I noticed my bicycle was taking the road well, its tires new and wide. We'd hit gravel bits and dirt bits, but mostly we rode on asphalt. But the asphalt wasn't the smooth black kind. It was the bumpy gray kind, and tightly packed with small stones. Weston's bike didn't do so well. Its tires too thin, too bald. He would shake terribly, and eventually an item, a shoe, say, would get knocked loose from his belongings and bounce away behind him, or the whole pack would slide off. In the beginning, he had stopped to fix his old bike and jury-rigged cargo without complaining. It was part of his message and mission to show that a cheap old bike could make it if you were willing to be patient and work with it. Now he would curse as he fixed things. The cold morning quickly turned oven hot. The sun was heavy on us, pushing my skin like an iron. I wore sunscreen, but as the hours went on, I worried I wasn't reapplying enough. My skin was red. I put on long sleeves and accepted the sweat just to avoid the burn. We spent the day bumping and shaking our way through dusty towns and unpaved roads. The semi-trucks left grooves in the dirt road like ripples in water. This made biking terrible. Our hands went numb from the battering. The towns we biked through mostly seemed to be hubs of the tomato plantations and places where workers lived. Cinder blocks were piled up and made into a store or a house. We went through lots of these towns, many without any sign of their names, but I mapped the route on Google Maps so the names scrolled past as we did. Camalú, Colonia Lomas de San Ramón, Colonia Nueva Era. The end of our fourth day biking was signaled by the sun getting close to the ocean. We needed a canyon or grove of oaks to camp beneath, but every spot we found was too close to human beings, too close to a farm or a shack or a busy walking path. We couldn't hide. We couldn't find a hotel either. Well, I found one, but when I asked if they had a vacancy, the blank-eyed woman at the counter said, without looking up, "No." But the moment we got back on the road, as I swerved to miss a nail, and Weston swerved to miss me, his front wheel bent in half. He tumbled hard from the bike. Weston was fine, he always is, but the wheel was beyond repair. He couldn't even roll the bike. He had to carry it on his shoulder. There was nothing to do but walk ourselves back to a gas station near the mean-spirited hotel. Of course, I thought. We just make it into the desert, finally into the hard part of the trip, and we're failing. I'm completely roasted from the sun, my skin hurts, and my legs hurt, and already we have nowhere to sleep. We can't even make it halfway down Baja. What if Weston's bike is impossible to replace? The only bikes I've seen down here are recycled mountain bikes. And where are we going to sleep? Is this a bad neighborhood? God, help us. Please help us. Show us a place to sleep, or send us help. We sat at the gas station for 30 minutes, hoping to hitchhike with any truck that would fit our bikes. But drivers shook their heads or pretended not to hear us. One guy listened to Weston for a minute, but when Weston slipped into English, he drove off. Weston went back to fooling with his tire. I watched some ants, wondering how they lived in a world without water. Then I smelled weed. Weston had rolled a joint. "I just realized this is my last one," he said. "Well, this situation sucks, so I suppose it's as good a time as any. Can't you get seriously in trouble with weed in Mexico?" "Yeah, but people are obviously ignoring us, and I can hide it quick." "I think maybe we should walk back toward town. This place is dead, and there's more people actually walking on the street." "Okay, let me finish this." The sun was very low now. As we walked in the deep gold that comes just before twilight, more vehicles and walkers crowded onto the road. The shacks and homes along this stretch of road all looked built in a hurry. Weston was frustrated, but holding his tongue. He had bought the cheapest bicycle he could, to prove that this trip could be done on a real budget. Now we were paying the real price, a mounting pile of inconveniences. I was mad at him, and he knew it. Suddenly, we heard someone speak English behind us. "Where are you going? Need some help?" in a thick Mexican accent. We turned around to see a short man with a broad smile and a baby face walking behind us. He wore dirty jeans and a loose-fitting t-shirt. "Do you know where a hotel is?" I asked. "The only one is right here, but they are full. They have only 3 rooms because the others are broken," he said. "Oh, there are no others?" "No," he said. "But you are travelers?" "Yes, we're biking down to South America," I said, hoping it would impress him. "You are welcome in my home. I like helping people, and I see this bicycle is broken. We can wait for the shop right here to open tomorrow, and then I take you in the morning on my way to work." He motioned his hand to a street just out of sight, implying that just out of view was a bike shop. This was our first invitation into the home of a stranger. I thought about my mom's warnings, her emails of beheadings. I think I would have been hesitant with a lot of men for fear of theft or worse. But Miguel had a sweet face and excellent English, and I had just prayed for a place to stay. Was this the universe answering? It never made sense that God would be so transactional. Prayer works, implies the harder you pray, the more you get what you asked for. But this prayer had worked, hadn't it? We said yes, and Miguel walked us off the road down into the neighborhood. Leading away from the one paved road was a grid of dirt roads, only they weren't dirt. Our bike tires sunk immediately into soft white sand, as soft as powder. The bikes couldn't roll at all, and loaded down with all the weight of our bags and panniers, they simply dug into the earth like a shovel. Which is when Miguel, without hesitation, took Weston's bike and hoisted it onto his shoulders. People stared at us as if Area 51 had released its aliens, two gringos flanking the small Mexican man like a Pelican V formation. Kids began trailing us, laughing and talking too fast to be understood. They stared at our strange bikes, so much shinier than the rusted and duct-taped mountain bikes they had. We passed flat-roofed houses that were little more than stucco boxes, flaking and cracked by the sun. Stray dogs ran around everywhere. It was almost dark when we got to Miguel's house, another box in a line of similar structures. Strung between the bare or dead trees out front were six or seven heavily laden clotheslines. Miguel asked us to wait for a moment while he talked to his wife. When she came to the door, she looked us up and down sternly. She was dark-skinned, regal, and severe. I saw a little girl peeking out from behind her. Then a lanky boy of about 12, sporting crooked eyeglasses, came out to talk. "Very nice to meet you," he said. "Sorry for my English. I am still learning." Miguel was thrilled. "Maybe tonight you can help my son with his homework. He has to write a speech in English and he needs help to make sure it is right. Is that okay? You will sleep in his room. He can sleep with us." We entered the house, which consisted of two rooms. Miguel gave us the grand tour. "In this room, we cook and my wife and I sleep, and our daughter sleeps with us here. We sleep here." He gestured to a double bed in the corner. A Spanish language game show was playing on the small TV. Next to the bed, a stained couch, a stove, a sink, and a few plastic chairs. Miguel led us into the second room. A small mattress with stained sheets and exposed springs lay on the floor, surrounded by tools, old toys, a stack of broken plastic lawn chairs, metal poles, possibly shower curtain rods, and empty beer boxes. A naked light bulb hung in the center of each room. A shared bathroom had a toilet and a showerhead, but no curtains. Gesturing to the bed, Miguel asked, "Is this okay? You will have to be very close. I know this is very different than America." He looked at us with a humbly furrowed brow and sweetness in his eyes. "Yes, of course, yes, oh my God, of course, this is amazing," I said. "My wife wants to make you a good dinner. I must run to the market to get some supplies, but I will be right back," Miguel said. "Oh, we will go with you and pay for everything. It's the least we can do," Weston said. He looked at me for confirmation, and I said, "Of course." "Oh, thank you," Miguel said. He laughed and slapped us on the back as if we were old friends. We crammed our bikes into the son's room and followed Miguel out the front door, followed him to the market, and bought everything he asked for. Meat, onions, cilantro. Weston asked him if he wanted ice cream, and Miguel didn't seem to hear. "I don't know if they have a freezer," I whispered. Weston's eyes got wide, shaken by his assumption, and nodded. Miguel asked gingerly if we could buy some beer, and we picked up a 24-pack of Tecate. He was thrilled. As we walked home, he told us about his family. "My son Alejandro is very smart. He is the top at his school. He will work in the U.S., no question. He is studying English, and, you saw, it's pretty good. He will get better. I am proud of him. My daughter, Litian, she is smart, but I don't know. She is light-skinned, that is very good, not like her mother. Alejandro has the dark skin like his mother, but he is smart, so he will be okay. My wife, her skin is too dark. Here, it is a bad thing to be so dark-skinned. People don't like her in this town because of it. It is racist here. She has indigenous in her. She is a beautiful woman, but she is very dark. I'm glad Litian is light-skinned. It will help her if she is not as smart as Alejandro. He asked if we wanted to smoke, meaning weed, and Weston said yes. Miguel took us down a different sandy street in the dark, found a man who seemed to just exist underneath a tree, and told us to wait by the wall. When he returned, he said he needed $20. Weston, who always seemed to manifest money from thin air for these moments, pulled out a 20 and handed it to him. Miguel slipped into the shadows for 20 minutes, but when he returned with the paper bag, he was grinning. By the time we got back to Miguel's home, his taciturn wife had finished frying the perfect hand-shaped tortillas. I looked at her differently now. I noticed her skin and thought about people being rude to her, about how she didn't speak much, and perhaps that was to stay invisible. She accepted the meat we'd bought and instructed us to sit on the couch. Alejandro appeared with his speech, written in English, and asked me in a crisp, rehearsed sentence, "Excuse me, do you mind if I practice my speech in English with you, if you please?" I obliged happily, and he fixed his glasses and began reciting. He was holding the paper, and his hand was shaking. He stopped after one sentence. "Please do tell me if my English has mistakes." "Okay, I will," I said, smiling with my whole face, in that way you do when you want to encourage someone in a tender moment. He read his work, which had a few misplaced or misconjugated words, but it was wonderful. I made some edits, and Alejandro was very pleased. He sat down beside me to scrutinize what I'd written. Miguel explained to me how important it was to him for his children to learn English. It was their ticket to a better life. He bragged how his son was the best in his school, the best English speaker in the entire town, how English could get him jobs in hotels and tourism and restaurants around here, or better yet, help him thrive when he made it to the United States. Miguel got me thinking about how strange it is to be born in a country whose influence has spread around the world like an infestation. The world's hunger to speak English is emblematic of this. Some cultures welcome our films, television, and music, or feel drawn by the prospect of money and power. Others resist. Either way, my culture is the most dominant on the planet, and I benefit from that. Sitting there watching Alejandro study my markup like it was holy scripture made me wonder, what moral weight does being the beneficiary of my dominant culture place on my shoulders? Miguel's wife made us fried tortillas and meat with cheese and beans, and it was delicious. She merely nodded as we lavished her with compliments in horrible Spanish. Increíble comida. We got very full and laughed, and Miguel told more stories. After a while, the fatigue of riding bikes all day caught up with us, compounded by social exhaustion from being guests on exhibit in such a tiny space. But Miguel kept handing us one beer after another. "Maybe we should sleep soon," I proposed finally. "We biked very hard today. We are so grateful. Oh yes, we will go into the other room." He leaped up and led us into Alejandro's room. We said our thank yous to the lady of the house and the kids. Miguel now sat down on the floor with a fresh six-pack of beer. "You aren't too tired, are you?" he asked with the eagerness of a kid afraid of being sent to bed. "Can we keep talking?" "We are really tired, but yes." Miguel handed out beers and went on talking. He was getting visibly drunk, and Weston and I had a what-have-we-done moment of eye contact with each other. But when Miguel started rolling joints, Weston perked up. Miguel stumbled up to open a window. "I was in Nebraska for 11 years," he said. "You know Nebraska?" "Yes, I've been there." I was about to say how boring it is. "It is so beautiful," Miguel said between puffs. "Such nice streets, nice people, so much work. I want to go back." He described it like it was paradise. "I had another wife then, with her two sons, my boys. They are with her still in the U.S. I had a problem and was deported, a bad problem. I can never go back legally. They will put me in jail for the rest of my life," he said. I wondered if he would tell us what he'd done. He didn't. I did try to sneak back in after they deported me the last time. You pay these guys $3,000 in Tijuana to sneak you over. They hide you in trucks, or sometimes they will pay you to take drugs through the tunnels in the deserts between San